Mr. Watson, Real 12. We're talking about your time with, you think, 40 Battalion, the Royal Army Pay Corps at Hurstbourne Park, Hampshire. Did you have any other duties besides keeping this
normal? No, I was in the only room or the central administration, it was called. There were one or two peculiar things there. We used to read a lot of the correspondence. The battalion dealt with the guards' pay, I think the Royal Artillery pay, and one other branch of the army. We used to read the letters because when one's dealing with pay, some of the guards and the rest of it were suffering because of their wives playing up. I can remember we used to get reports from the private investigators or the CID investigators who used to go around when a guardsman or somebody else complained about he thought his wife wasn't playing true to him. One particular instance sticks in my mind where there was a letter from an investigator who was dispatched to a house in Liverpool. This guardsman suspected his wife wasn't playing true to him, and the private investigator reported this house occupied a corner site of two roads, and the flank wall abutted a road. And this guardsman's wife entertained various gentlemen so much that the local lads had written on the flank wall, "Home for Foreign Soldiers." The investigator's report concluded that she was a glorified prostitute and had to report accordingly to the colonel of the Guards Regiment. We used to read things like that because it affected pay, because he then cancelled the allowance he was making to his wife. Apart from that, there wasn't a lot of interest. The adjutant of the camp was a DCM from the First World War, an Irishman who knew nothing but was nevertheless quite a strict disciplinarian. One other little thing that happened there, while we were there, an army plane crashed into a field adjacent to camp. And we had to go and get all the records, and our job was to pour through the ACIs, the Army Command Instructions, and to report on the exact procedure following the downing of an aircraft. It was quite complicated, really. The chap got killed, incidentally. He was an artillery spotter in a small biplane, but it crashed into the field, and the battalion fire brigade had him go and get him out and rescue him and bring him back. But we had a pull through the Army Command Instructions and do the necessary notifications to various people. I can't remember a lot else about this place. We used to enjoy the concerts there. The celebrations when people left, because
what were those parties like, demob parties? What would a typical one be like?
We generally used to go down to a local pub and have a few drinks. And we, bear in mind, we didn't have a lot of money. I think my pay then was about 7 shillings a day, 49 shillings a week. Perhaps not bad, but not on the other hand generous, I suppose. And then, of course, I used to spend money. Being so near to home, we used to spend money in going up to London, up to home at the weekends. I can remember one little instance when my friend, who didn't believe in buying them, I never used to believe in buying railway tickets either, but my friend went up one day, and this ticket had been clipped about 7 or 8 times, so he held his thumb over all of these 7 or 8 times. He gave it to the ticket collector. the ticket collector took it out of his hand. He looked at these 7 or 8 clippings, turned it over, saw that it was out of date, clipped it again and gave it back to him and never said another word. He was thinking the ticket collector, obviously the ticket collector must have been in the services himself and felt sympathetic towards him. Either that or he'd seen the wound stripe on his arm and his DCM ribbon. But he led him off. I was quite lucky too. I never used to play the field there every weekend.
How did you come to be demobilised then?
Well, I was demobilised in December 45. I think my demobilisation group was 44, which was...
1946? December 1946?
No.
45. How long...
46, December 46.
46, yes. Yeah.
In other words, I was about a year at December 46.
And what happened when you were demobilised?
Well, I received a pension on demobilisation. I was awarded a pension, a disablement pension.
How much was that and how was it decided?
I think it was 7 shillings a week. It was not a full disablement, it was a part disablement.
And what happened when you actually demobilised?
Well, I'd made my mind up when I'd left the Belgian bank. In fact, I told the staff officer there that I wouldn't be coming back. He said, I went up to see him. I said, I'm demobilised in a week's time. I won't be coming back, sir. He said, no, he said, I didn't know that you wouldn't be coming back. I had a friend, a school friend, with whom I kept contact, and he had a brother who started up a building business. And now, knowing that I'd been trained commercially in bookkeeping, typewriting, writing shorthand, I was quite able to take over a full set of books and prepare a balance sheet and final accounts for anybody. So I started off in this building company in January of 47. Now, the winter of 46-47 was a terrible winter. It was terrible in every respect because of the shortage of coal, the rivers froze, and the building trade obviously had to come to a full stop for about 8 weeks. And one literally couldn't even do decorating because the stuff used to freeze in the bales. And I went into this building company, and I used to look after the office. So I did all the bookkeeping, prepared the final accounts, and to audit and prepare for the Inland Revenue. I liked being in the building trade because I used to get outside to some of the sites. Don't forget, this was in the days of war damage repairs, and there was plenty of work about. Incidentally, I'd met my wife in the Army Pay Corps, and we got engaged in 1947. We were subsequently married in 1948. So I had plenty to interest me apart from the work. But I enjoyed the work. I enjoyed the bookkeeping, and I enjoyed learning about the building trade, which was all new to me. In fact, I used to enjoy it so much, I used to take catalogues home and read through them and ask one of the three partners of this firm, was a very open sort of a chap. He'd been a carpenter, he knew the trade inside out and backwards, and he said to me one day, he said, look, Ken, I was called Ken by then, not Charlie. The building trade is entirely common sense. If you're doing something that's not common sense, it's wrong. But I used to take these books home. If I didn't understand what things were for, I used to ask him, he used to tell me. I used to cut glass as an overtime job because I was ever anxious to earn extra money. We used to have glass delivered in large sheets, and I used to cut it for the various jobs, thousands and thousands of pieces. I've never lost the ability to cut glass. Most of it is being sure about what you're doing. I also, the firm was doing very well financially. In fact, they used to come in for a thing called excess profits, that's EBT. Despite the fact that I warned them that they were making good profits, they didn't seem to cotton on to the fact that they'd got to buy a few more capital things. What they should have done in retrospect was bought a bit more equipment. But they used to take me to football matches. I went to the cup final in 1947 and 1948 because they had enough money to buy the tickets for it. I've never been to a cup final since. And they treated me on the whole very, very well indeed. Learning about the building trade was something which I got in mind for future use. After I'd been there about 3 years, I said to them, look, I think I know enough now to go outside and assist them looking after jobs outside, all green materials and the rest of it. They said, well, you do that, but we still want the books kept. So go outside and get a bit of experience outside, which I did. And I learned a lot from watching other people. Generally by using one's common sense, which was all knowledge which assisted me in later life. I got married, as I said, in 1948. Bear in mind that there were still rations for everything, food, clothes, furniture. One could not buy anything without permits. We managed to find a... I never wanted to rent a house. My parents had rented houses all their lives and never achieved anything. So I made up my mind that we would buy a place. We found a house at Catford, which was a four-bedroom house, the upper part of which was occupied by a young married couple, the lower part of which had been occupied by a widowed lady who was in excess of 80. She died, and her son, who lived at Hayes, not far from here, wanted to get rid of the house as soon as possible. Obviously, with part possession, he would achieve what he would have achieved had the house been wholly empty. So we managed to buy the house for £1,200. It had a 950-year lease still remaining, a ground rent of £5.08 a year, which was fixed in 1899, which wasn't variable. Which seemed to be a very reasonable ground rent. And I mean, at least 850 years is taken out the same, it's freehold. We bought this place, which of course, having been occupied by an old lady, was completely out of date. It wanted replumbing, redecorating, rewiring, absolutely everything. And luckily, there was some more damage repairs still existing, which I got the firm I worked for to do. So, of course, the house was then, after a couple of years' hard work, turned into quite a reasonable building. One little story I must tell you about. One Sunday morning, I'm painting the front of the house off a ladder. The ladder slipped. I was left hanging on the first floor window sill. An old lady coming along, going to church with a Bible under her arm, said, "Can I help you?" I said, "No, madam, just stand on one side, I'll jump down." Or I jumped down the bottom successfully.
Now, how had your war injuries affected you at all?
Oh, yes, yes. What used to happen in those days, one never got into a cinema without queuing. There are always queues, and if I stood for anything beyond 5 minutes, I used to feel the pain in my left leg.
And how long did that last for?
Well, it lasted for several years.
Did you continue? Do you still get the pension now?
Or no, they commuted the pension after about 4 or 5 years. I've got the records of it somewhere. They commuted the pension and gave me a lump sum of £30 or £40, which at that time I was very grateful to receive.
And does it?
I wasn't worried about the £7 a week.
Does it affect you now?
The leg has not affected me for probably 30 years.
What about your mental effects of your war? I mean, did you have any problems?
I've never had any mental effects. I sometimes bring back to mind, I can remember, one of the worst things I can remember is a German chap leaning up against a tree. He's lost both legs, one arm completely at the shoulder, both legs, the upper legs. He's fully conscious and speaking and asking for a doctor. That's about the worst thing I can remember. Somebody giving him morphine, but we were advancing fairly quickly at the time. We were in no position. We radioed back for stretcher bearers, but whether they got to him or not, I don't know. We had to push on.
And does that memory upset you? Or,
it doesn't upset me. I mean, a lot of the people I saw shot and thrown about, they upset me initially, never having seen a dead body in my life. Obviously, some of their own tank crews, I can remember having his head blown off by a Panzerfaust, a co-driver in a Sherman. And the technical adjutant just pulling the body out just like that, not turning a hair about it. I didn't like the look of it, but those sort of things have never worried me. I've never had nightmares over them. I've never had any form of shell shock or worry.
Now, what about your links with the old regiment? You said that Harry Axton kept in touch with you.
Harry Axton... Harry Axton always kept in touch with me. When he was originally, because he came from the northwest, Liverpool area, when he originally worked at Sheffield, he used to come down to London now and again. Whenever he came down, he used to see me in the hotel called Brown's Hotel, I think, and we used to have a drink and a meal together. He then moved down to Waldingham, WLD. INGHAM, which is just north of the M29 now. And he had a half a house there, and he invited me and my wife over to see him with his wife. He married a bit later than I did. And whenever he moved to his various houses, he'd got a job, as I say, with Brixton Estate, and he's always consistently kept contact with me. Consistently. He sent me both the divisional history initially and then the regimental history later on.
Now, what about the contacts with Fife and Forfar themselves?
I've never contacted the Fife and Forfar. I never heard from them. I didn't know they had an old comrades association, for want of a better term, until Harry Axton phoned me up one evening this year and said to me, "Did you know there's a thing called the South of the Border Group?" And I said, "No, Harry." He said, "Would you like to join?" I said, "Yes." He said, "I'll get the chap to send you the details." And the chap sent the details from Dorset. And I joined immediately and paid my 2 years' dues. But I never knew one existed. I wasn't like the other gentleman we saw at our table at the reunion. We thought everybody else was dead. I did think there'd be a few alive. Well, I knew Harry Axton was for starting. I know that Harry Axton is in contact with one or two other officers. I don't think he sees them very much because I think they're a bit hidebound and won't travel like me. Harry Axton, incidentally, is he's not allowed himself to degenerate. He physically suffers because he still gets a full pension, and he was quite severely wounded in North Africa.
Before he joined you then?
Before he joined the Fife and Forfar Army. Why he ever was allowed, or why he ever joined a fully active service regiment, I don't know. I mean, he must have been very, very enthusiastic.
Thank you very much.